Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin, of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, here we are together at the KHOI studio for the first time. Welcome.
It's very exciting, Dennis, to be here in the same room with you.
Indeed. We're going to make the most of this tonight because we're doing an hour-long broadcast right here at KHOI in the studio. Well, Laura, we need that hour because one story dominated the news in Iowa last week. What happened at the state Supreme Court? The court issued its ruling in a case involving Iowa's 2018 law that banned nearly all abortions in the state after about 6 weeks of pregnancy. To simplify things, on a tie vote, the court kept the current state law allowing abortions up to 20 weeks in place. We are going to cover all the angles of that decision, what it was, what it means, reaction to it, and what possibly happens next. Laura, let's start it off. What happened at the state Supreme Court?
Well, this was unusual in several ways. First of all, a tie outcome in the Iowa Supreme Court is not very common. It was possible because one of the justices, Dana Oxley, recused herself from the case. And the other thing that was very unusual was that normally when the Iowa Supreme Court deadlocks like that, they don't issue opinions. But in this case, three of the justices issued very detailed opinions explaining their thought process and where they were coming from. And I want to emphasize that I've seen some coverage that says the Iowa Supreme Court blocked the law from going into effect. No, the Iowa Supreme Court took no action. They could not take action because there was no majority holding. And the effect of that was to leave the lower court ruling in place. And the lower court ruling was that that 2018 abortion ban law should not be reinstated. But if the lower court had resolved the case the other way, then this tie outcome in the Iowa Supreme Court would have had the opposite effect. It would mean that abortion would, in effect, be banned already in Iowa. So the Iowa Supreme Court did not take any action. It left, by operation of law, it left that lower court ruling in effect.
And why did that one justice recuse herself, resulting in only six justices voting?
Well, the Iowa Supreme Court justices do not typically reveal the reason for their recusal, but in this case, it was fairly obvious. Dana Oxley worked for a Cedar Rapids-based law firm before she was appointed to the Iowa Supreme Court 3 years ago, and that law firm represents the Emma Goldman Clinic in Iowa City. And Emma Goldman Clinic was a party to this lawsuit. Although it's known as Planned Parenthood of the Heartland v. Reynolds, the Emma Goldman Clinic was also a plaintiff. And so it would be normal for an Iowa Supreme Court justice to recuse from cases involving their former law partners.
Obviously, on the 3-3 vote, there was a deep disagreement among the justices. Chief Justice Susan Christensen and Justices Edward Mansfield and Thomas Waterman favored affirming the district court's order. What was Waterman's rationality for this?
Yeah, so Justice Waterman wrote the opinion that was joined by Justice Mansfield and the Chief Justice Susan Christensen. And it was very interesting. What it boiled down to was, first of all, they say the court has the discretion whether to hear this kind of appeal, and they would deny the appeal. It in part because it's not timely. This case was resolved more than 3 years ago. The state did not appeal at that time. But more to the point, he got into one of the key issues for the Polk County District Court judge last December, which was that the underlying law had not changed, whereas the U.S. Supreme Court last year, when it overturned Roe v. Wade and Casey, said that abortion regulations are subject to the lowest standard of legal scrutiny. That's called rational basis review. The Iowa Supreme Court did not do that. The Iowa Supreme Court, in reversing its own abortion rights precedent, and that was an opinion written by Justice Mansfield, said that we're going to leave what's called the undue burden standard in place for now. And then in further litigation, the parties can argue over what the standard should be. So under this undue burden standard, everybody agrees, even the state acknowledges, that this law banning almost all abortions after about 6 weeks, the estimate is it would ban about 98% of abortions that currently take place, that this would pose an undue burden to someone seeking an abortion. And so that's why that was the main reason for that he would have affirmed the district court ruling.
Justices Christopher McDonald, Matthew McDermott, and David May favored reversing the district court.
Yes, and there were some very strong words exchanged in these opinions. And again, it's not normal that the justices even write opinions in the case of a tie outcome, but both Justice McDonald and Justice McDermott wrote separate opinions that each of the other two justices joined, and they were very critical of their colleagues. They said that the underlying law, which was the Roe v. Wade and the Casey precedents, the underlying law had changed. the Iowa Supreme Court had reversed its own abortion rights precedent. And in for that reason, they thought there was no justification for preserving this permanent injunction on the 2018 law. And they didn't agree with the idea that it should go back to the legislature to see whether the legislature would pass this law again. They didn't agree with the idea that there's some kind of a time limit on whether when someone can file to dissolve a permanent injunction. And again, very harsh words exchanged. And in some, and I mean, I really wonder how this is going to affect the workings of the court going forward, because it's just not common to see justices taking shots at each other like that in print.
As you might imagine, the reaction to this was vigorous on both sides, leading off with Governor Reynolds. She said, quote, "Today, to say that today's lack of action by the Iowa Supreme Court is a disappointment is an understatement," and she vowed to continue the fight.
Yes, and remember, just Governor Reynolds has appointed 5 of the 7 current justices. She appointed all 3 who would have agreed with the state's position and would have allowed that law to go into effect. She also appointed the Chief Justice Susan Christensen and Justice Oxley, who recused. The only 2 justices who were appointed by Governor Branstad are Justices Waterman and Mansfield. So obviously, the governor, in bringing this case last summer, she must have felt that she had a pretty good likelihood of succeeding, and so it was very disappointing to her.
And the rest of the Republican reaction is pretty much what you'd expect. GOP Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitford saying Senate Republicans have a consistent record of defending life, including passage of the heartbeat bill. Pat Grassley, Attorney General Brenna Byrd, all Republicans, they are all vowing to do something.
Well, and it was interesting, the Attorney General Brenna Byrd's reaction. I mean, the handling of this whole case is interesting because last year, the Democratic Attorney General at the time, Tom Miller, he declined to defend this law and defend the state. So the state retained private counsel. And after Brenna Byrd came into office in January, she issued a statement saying, we're bringing this case back. The state is going to represent. But her lawyers did not argue. It was a private attorney who argued this case. So I wasn't sure exactly what was going on with that. But the Senate and the House majority leaders, yes, they expressed disappointment with the ruling. But what didn't they say? They didn't say that they would pass an identical law. They didn't say whether they would pass a law that maybe even goes further than the 2018 law. And they didn't say whether they would go forward and try to amend the Iowa Constitution to make clear that there is no constitutionally protected right to abortion.
And we're going to talk a bit more about that in just a few minutes. But on the Democratic Party side, exactly what you would expect in terms of a reaction. Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart saying, I am thrilled that the state Supreme Court will not stand in the way of Iowans who need abortion care. And that basically was down the line with the Democrats.
Yes. I mean, just an enormous sense of relief from Democrats on Friday. This opinion was published at about 8:30 in the morning on Friday. And just all day, I was hearing from Democrats who were relieved. Given the timetable of how long it would take for a new appeal, a new case of litigating a new abortion ban to reach the Iowa Supreme Court, it's very likely that for at least a year, but probably more likely close to 2 years, abortion is going to remain legal in Iowa. And that is why the Democrats are so relieved.
Now, one of the strongest reactions came this weekend, 24, 48 hours after the decision, when Bob Vanderplaats, who's the president and CEO of the Family Leader, really went farther than any lawmaker has gone, almost in terms of threatening the 3 Supreme Court justices who voted against reinstating.
Yes, and he was the leading figure in 2009 and 2010 following the Iowa Supreme Court's unanimous ruling that paved the way for same-sex marriage in Iowa. He was really leading the charge to oust the 3 Supreme Court justices who were on the ballot, and of course that was successful. It allowed Governor Terry Branstad then to appoint 3 new justices. And so when he came out and said that these justices didn't handle things the right way and they should be removed, people do pay attention to that.
So how seriously should the justices take his implied threat? He said they should either resign, be impeached, or be ousted.
Yes. Well, ousting them is going to be difficult because all 3 who would have affirmed the district court ruling, that's the Chief Justice Christensen and Justices Waterman and Mansfield, they were all retained in 2020. They won't be on the ballot again until 2028. And in fact, Justices Waterman and Mansfield are going to be very close to the mandatory retirement age by then anyway. So that's a non-starter. In terms of impeachment, it requires, kind of similar to Congress, the Iowa House would have to vote a majority to impeach the justices, and then the Senate would have to remove them from office by a two-thirds vote. And as we've discussed this year, Republicans do hold exactly two-thirds of the seats in the Iowa Senate. So, but they couldn't afford to lose a single person. So I don't get the sense right now that the legislative leaders are eager to go down that road, but I guess we'll see what kind of pressure they get from their base. Of course, social conservatives, a very important part of the Republican Party base in Iowa.
Let's talk about what options state Republicans have now. You briefly alluded to it. One thing they could do is pass a new law restricting abortion, but that may not be as easy to generate consensus on. And you wrote about that this weekend.
Yes, they definitely will have to pass some kind of new law restricting abortion. Their base demands it. They've promised it. But the problem is getting to an agreement within their caucus. I expect that if they can reach agreement on a policy, that they will come back before January. The governor will call a special legislative session to get this done, to start the clock so that the litigation over the new law can start sooner rather than later. But the problem Republicans have is, even though they have very large legislative majorities right now, there is a lot of diversity within their caucus. Now, there aren't really any pro-choice Republicans anymore. But there are a number of people who certainly don't want to go any farther than the 2018 law, perhaps maybe even want to beef up the exceptions in that law. And then there were 20 Republicans in the Iowa House who co-sponsored a bill that would completely ban abortion. It was modeled on the Texas law that went into effect last year. It would ban all elective abortion, even before 6 weeks, no exception for rape, no exception for incest. And so those people may not be willing to vote for something that only goes as far as the 2018 law. So they have to get everybody on the same page. And they definitely, if they call a special legislative session, they're not going to want to stick around for a long time. They're just going to want to come in and pass this in one day and go home.
Yeah. So the question is, would the governor want to push for a complete ban on abortion? Would she go for the same 6-week ban that she wanted reinstated? I don't see her going for 12 weeks like North Carolina did. I would think it's going to be a complete ban or 6 weeks.
I think no chance that she goes for something like a 12-week ban. She has said ever since she signed that law in 2018, she calls it the heartbeat law. She has always said that life begins when there's a beating heart. And I just can't imagine that she would sign any bill that did not at least ban abortions after 6 weeks. I don't know whether she is on board. You know, she's very competitive with other Republican governors. This is something she's talked about in interviews, and a number of Republican states have passed these 6-week bans. Only a few have completely banned abortion, and I just don't know. Her office, of course, hasn't responded to reporter questions about what is her goal here. I don't think that they can get a majority vote in the legislature for a complete abortion ban, and so I doubt that she will publicly advocate for that. I expect that what they will land on eventually is something very similar to the 2018 law, but perhaps with the exceptions worded a little bit differently.
So my guess would be, and we've alluded to this, that she will call a special session this summer because she doesn't want this to be in the legislature next year during an election year.
Well, I think that there's a lot of pressure within the Republican Party, a lot of pressure to get this done soon. And I think as soon as they can agree on language that they know can get 51 votes in the House and 26 votes in the Senate, I think they'll call a session. I just don't know how long that will take. We've seen that sometimes they can spend months haggling over what to do with property taxes or any number of other issues, and it all gets resolved at the very end of the legislative session. So now, I mean, there's no firm deadline when they would have to deal with this. But I know that a lot of people in their party are not going to want to wait until next January, partly because, as you say, it's an election year. But just in practical terms, the longer they wait, that's month after month of abortion remaining legal in Iowa.
They could also pursue, as you suggested, a constitutional amendment. They've already passed it once. It has to pass the legislature one more time and then go on the ballot. But will there be memories of what happened in Kansas and Kentucky where voters had a chance to ban it and they didn't?
I am getting the strong sense that Republican leadership does not want to go forward with that constitutional amendment. The Iowa Constitution is very difficult to amend. Two separately elected legislatures have to approve the same language. Then it goes on a statewide ballot. And the way the abortion amendment was drafted, it passed both chambers in 2021, and it was drafted very much like what was on the ballot last year in Kentucky, that it said that the state constitution does not protect any right to abortion or funding for abortion. And when they were passing it, they were saying, you know, we just want to make sure that abortion isn't expanded up to the point of the baby's birth. And but what people can see now, of course, that was before the Dobbs opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. Now people can see that many states have already banned abortion. And so when this went on the ballot in Kansas last August, it lost by 18 points. That's a landslide. In Kentucky, which is a much more Republican-leaning state than Iowa, it lost by about 5 points. So again, closer, but not really that close. And I don't think that Republican leaders in Iowa want to roll the dice on putting this to a popular vote that they might lose.
So let's bottom line all of this. We've spent 15 minutes talking about what happened last week. Bottom line, abortion is still legal in Iowa up to 20 weeks.
It is legal in Iowa. It is very likely that the legislature is going to try to pass some other ban, but it would take a long time for litigation over that new law to reach the Iowa Supreme Court. And then we don't know how the Iowa Supreme Court would resolve that, whether they would say that this is okay under a rational basis review, that the state has a legitimate interest in banning abortion, or whether they would say, you know, this law presents an undue burden on people seeking an abortion, and this is not allowed under the Iowa Constitution, so it's really up in the air.
We hope we've simplified this for you, and we'll be talking about this, obviously, week by week, and we're going to move on to another topic after I say it's 15 after the hour, and this is Dennis and Laura on Capital Week, and if it sounds a little different tonight, well, it is. We're going to explain why at the bottom of the half hour, and we are going a full hour tonight. All right, Capital Week Caucus Almanac. Laura, where's our theme song on that? President Trump pleaded not guilty last week to 37 federal charges. Absolutely not a surprise. Not a surprise that he also blowtorched the prosecution afterward.
Yes, he did. And, you know, he feels that this is a witch hunt, that he's being treated very unfairly. And what's interesting is he keeps commenting publicly on the case, even just today, giving another interview to Fox News. Typically, this is not how a criminal defendant behaves. The attorneys would say the less said publicly, the better. But this is, it doesn't appear to be hurting him so far in the presidential race. And so he's going to keep going.
Absolutely. In fact, after his plea last week in Miami, he told supporters at a gathering that night, they want to take away my freedom because I will never let them take away your freedom. And the crowd ate it up, and the polls show that they continue to eat it up.
Yes, it's certainly the national polls. I haven't seen any recent Iowa poll, but I did see there was a poll last week out of New Hampshire. Former President Trump still has a commanding lead over the rest of the field. And in the national polling, he has a very large lead. So it's somebody is going to have to try to take him down, or something has to dramatically change among the Republican base of the electorate.
There are now 12 other candidates in the field besides former President Trump. Another new GOP presidential contender jumped into the race last week. Miami Republican Mayor Francis Suarez filed paperwork. Third Florida candidate in the field, joining Trump and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Kind of interesting to figure out what his path is.
Yeah. Well, of course, every person who joins the field benefits Donald Trump, because when you're ahead and you have a commanding lead, it's much easier to win a plurality in state after state if you're competing against 10 other people rather than competing head to head against one person. And I think any other candidate from Florida getting in the race, it has to hurt Ron DeSantis. I mean, I don't think that the mayor of Miami is going to be a strong presidential candidate regardless, but to the extent that he has any support at all, it can only come at the expense of the non-Trump candidates.
South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, another Republican presidential contender, returned to Iowa this past week, and he spoke to voters in Pella, called for a return of the American dream.
Yes, and Pella is one of the most bedrock conservative towns in Iowa. They typically have very high turnout, and so that's why you see so many presidential candidates holding events in Pella. And Tim Scott, I mean, he continues to be received very favorably. I still see him when I listen to excerpts from his speeches. To me, he still sounds like he's running for vice president instead of running for president.
Vivek Ramaswamy came back to Iowa, and he went farther than some of the other candidates, in fact, farther than any of them gone. He said if he were elected president, and the odds on that are very slim, but if he were elected president, he would pardon former President Trump, and he challenged the other GOP candidates to say they would do so as well.
And again, yes, I see Vivek Ramaswamy as somebody who's auditioning for a role in the next Republican administration. He's only 37 years old. He often says he's the first millennial to run for president on the Republican ticket. And so he's clearly not going to be the nominee. But I think he's going to be really careful over the next year not to burn any bridges with Donald Trump, and probably is going to be trying as well not to burn any bridges with Ron DeSantis, just in case.
Larry Elder also came back to Iowa. He's a former talk show host out in California. He said he was disturbed by the politicization of the U.S. criminal justice system, called for states to create commissions that could remove prosecutors who refuse to enforce laws. And in a way, he's following the game plan that others are following in the Republican field. They're criticizing the prosecution without ever talking about the charges against Trump.
That's right. And he stepped in a little bit last week because he said he has this idea that about a way that would make it easier to remove local prosecutors. And then he strongly suggested that Iowa's Attorney General Brenna Byrd supports his plan. And so her office put out a statement to say, no, that this is not an idea that they've endorsed. They haven't formally reviewed his idea. So, I mean, that kind of exaggerating. I mean, he knows that Brenna Byrd is very popular among the Republican base, and that's probably why he wanted to imply that she supports the plan. But yes, there's an idea. I mean, and this goes back even before Trump, really. There's an idea that there are these lawless Democratic-controlled cities, and we need to take control of them. And that's something that I think a lot of Iowa Republicans are very receptive to, that concept.
So it's a very interesting concept that most of the Republican candidates are running against Trump without ever mentioning, of course, his name. And the exceptions are Chris Christie, who doesn't hesitate to blast Trump, and Asa Hutchinson, who says he shouldn't be running. So I wonder how effective that campaign is going to be. I think we know the answer. You're running against a man without ever mentioning who he is.
Yeah, well, you really can't. When there's such a prohibitive front runner, you can't run against that person without mentioning the name. I mean, there's an argument in campaign management circles that you don't want to talk about your opposition. You want to talk about yourself. You want to focus on your own message. But that doesn't work when there's one person who has such a commanding lead over the rest of the field. So that's why I really don't see most of these other candidates as genuinely campaigning to get the nomination. I think they're hoping to raise their profile. Maybe they'll get a job in the next administration. And that's worked for a lot of people.
So here we are, the third week of June in 2023. We are together in the studio for the first time. It's time to look each other in the eye and make a prediction. My prediction is, and I'll go on record on this, barring unforeseen catastrophe, all right, former President Trump gets the Republican nomination.
Yes, I find it very hard to see how anybody else could defeat him for the nomination right now. It's just, I don't really see a path for anybody.
Even if he is convicted. He won't be, by the way, because they're going to delay it well past the election. I just don't see him losing the nomination.
Well, these trials take a long time, and there can be lots of procedural things that happen. But certainly, before the Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire primary, it's not going to be resolved. And he has a very strong lead. I mean, I don't see Ron DeSantis or anyone else putting together the kind of campaign that can overcome Trump in either of those states. And then what's the path to winning on Super Tuesday or any of the other states if you've lost decisively in Iowa, New Hampshire?
Right. And now we have the Democrats. Yes, the Democrats made news this past weekend, not in a good way necessarily. Meeting in Minneapolis on Friday, the DNC, Democratic National Committee's Rules and Bylaws Committee, just said no to Iowa Democrats' plans for a reimagined caucus system. So bad news for the caucus. Where do we stand on Democrats' Iowa caucus? Or do we stand? Do the Democrats stand?
Well, it's funny because I have been saying for a long time that I think, you know, the party's over. We had a nice run that Iowa Democrats did, and it's just not going to happen. But then I thought this plan, the delegate selection plan that they came up with, I thought was very clever, that it satisfies the new Iowa law. It also says, because they aren't going to announce the results of the presidential preference that's going to happen by mail-in voting, because they're not going to announce that the same night as the precinct caucuses, it seems to be okay under the law. And to me, it seems like that could satisfy the DNC's window. The reason why the DNC rejected the Iowa plan is that it doesn't have a date attached. The DNC wants a guarantee that Iowa is not going to announce those presidential results until after that early state window. And the Iowa Democratic Party right now just wants to leave things open and be flexible because we don't know yet. The date of the Iowa caucuses hasn't been set. All they've said is they're going to hold precinct caucuses on the same day as the Republican Party of Iowa does. So, I mean... As Scott Brennan, who is on the DNC representing Iowa, I mean, he was striking a hopeful tone in an interview after this meeting. He said, you know, he still thinks that there's a chance. And, you know, South Carolina and New Hampshire, they haven't done what they need to do to satisfy. And he just thinks this DNC preferred calendar is not really going to work out. And maybe they'll come back and let Iowa do this thing. So I don't know that Iowa Democratic leadership is not giving up on this. I don't think it's very likely. But I do think that this plan is clever. And it could be that if they announce that the date that they're going to reveal the presidential preferences of Iowans, if that's after that early state window, then we could still hold precinct caucuses earlier than that and be okay.
So they're basically hoping for the Hail Mary miracle here.
Absolutely. And I mean, look, President Biden for a long time has said that we shouldn't be using caucuses for presidential selection, and that it's within the Democratic Party nationally, there's just a lot of eagerness to get past this old calendar. A lot of people would have been happy, frankly, to displace New Hampshire as well as Iowa. But it is a problem that, I mean, President Biden prefers this calendar with South Carolina going first and Georgia going before Iowa. But those states are Republican controlled, and they have not changed the state law in the way that the DNC desires. And I think that's what gives some Iowa Democrats hope, that there's really none of these early states are going to be fully compliant with what the DNC says they want.
One more note before we take a break on the half hour, and this is a national note. Daniel Ellsberg passed away last week at the age of 92. A lot of people don't know who Daniel Ellsberg is or was. He was so important in the 1970s, the subject really of a U.S. Supreme Court decision. It impacted the Nixon presidency. He was a giant back in the 1970s.
Yes, in this case, he disclosed what became known as the Pentagon Papers and about how the U.S. got deeply involved in Vietnam. And it was very important. It was a case that was important for press freedom and transparency. And this really, like, as you say, you really can't overstate the importance of that. And just it just goes to show that one person can have a very large impact.
Indeed so. All right, it's 27 minutes after the hour, wherever you are with us, all across the country or all across the world. And normally, Laura and I would be saying goodbye at this point, but tonight, it's different. We're going to stay on the air for an additional half hour. We'd always planned to do this. And we're going to rejoin you in just a couple of minutes at the bottom of the hour. We're going to reopen the broadcast, and we're going to explain why we're going an extra half hour. But first, we're going to have a musical interlude, and this is going to be significant. I'll explain it on the other end. That is Les and Larry Elgart, Sentimental Journey. Why did we play that as we reopen this broadcast at 7:30? I should have said 30 minutes after the hour, wherever we are across the United States. This is Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin on Capital Week. We're going to go another half hour, and the reason we played that is because this is a special event for both of us. We are both here in Ames, rather than in front of our computers, wherever we happen to be broadcasting from. This is the first time we've been together, Laura. In fact, unbelievably enough, this is the first time after 2.5 years of doing this broadcast you and I have ever met in person.
It is amazing. I mean, we started the broadcast in February of 2021, really still near the height of the COVID pandemic, and people weren't doing a lot of things in person. And then last year, of course, I broke my ankle, as
you
we discussed.
Did.
I wasn't mobile
you
for
weren't.
Months and months, and
yes.
just not easy to get around. And so now, and Dennis doesn't live in Iowa full time, so it's very exciting to get to meet in person.
We were put together right after the 2020 election, in fact, the day after. We'd never heard of each other, and Ursula Rudenberg put us together to talk about what happened in Iowa, where Donald Trump had won. And we hit it off, and she said, why don't you guys think about doing a broadcast? Well, why not? We called it Capital Week after Washington Week in Review, and we did a half an hour because they can do a half an hour and cover the country. We figured we could do a half an hour and cover Iowa. And I figured, okay, we can do this for 6 or 7 weeks. It's going to be good, and then we'll run out of stuff to say. We haven't run out of stuff in 124 weeks.
Well, I knew I'd never run out of things to say about Iowa politics, but I thought, actually, at first, when I talked to Ursula, I thought maybe I would just periodically be calling in to local talk or other programs to talk about what was happening during the legislative session. And I thought the show might be something that KHOI would want to air while the legislature was in session, which is only about 4 months a year. And I was very excited when people wanted to continue the show after that, because for me, I'm always happy to talk about state government, campaigns, and elections. There's always a lot going on.
You have this extensive experience in covering Iowa politics, years of covering the legislature. I'd had years of covering national politics in a variety of cities across the country. And I will have to say this, you are an absolute delight to work with on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, because you are incredibly smart. You make me better at doing this. My job is simply to get us on and off the air. And we have worked together so well. We didn't know how this was going to work on the first week or two, but it works beautifully.
No, I mean, at first we were kind of winging it, I guess. But Dennis always, he prepares the run of show, so we know what we're going to talk about. I know that we're going to be kept on track and go out on time, and it's really a lot of fun.
So that's us. That's who we are, and we are going to be here for a while. I'm planning to do this. I would like to do this at least through next year's election and probably beyond. How about you?
Absolutely. I'm game. I mean, I'm always happy to talk about Iowa politics. I've been writing about Iowa politics since 2007, but I haven't appeared on the radio very often, frankly, and it's fun for me. There are a lot of topics we can talk about on the show that I don't have time to write about separately, so it's good for me as well.
And your blog site is Bleeding Heartland. I mentioned it at the top of every show. It is excellent, and working with you has been a great experience for me. I look forward to it. I wouldn't imagine, barring again catastrophe, pulling away next year because, gosh, we have the caucuses and we have the election coming up and it's a new legislative session, maybe a special session later this summer. Who knows what's going to happen?
Possibly. I mean, there's always something. And sometimes people ask me, are they going to run out of things to do in the legislature? But that will never happen. And we know that abortion is going to be an issue. We know they're probably going to come back and work on more changes to the tax code. And there's still some unfinished business from this year, even though this was an incredibly productive legislative session for Republicans. There are always more things they can talk about.
Let's talk about the Democrats again. This is a follow-up to last week's story. New developments in the ousting of State Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls. And this gets more and more interesting.
Yes, so the Senate Democrats are really at a low point right now. They have 16 of the 50 seats in the Iowa Senate. It's the lowest point they've been as a party since the early 1970s. And as we discussed last week, that there was a vote to replace Zach Walls, who had been the leader for a few years, with Pam Yoakum, who is one of the longest-serving members of the Iowa legislature. And what the new development last week, which I think was first reported by the Cedar Rapids Gazette, was that former Senate Majority Leader Mike Gronstahl, who was an absolute fixture in the legislature for almost 30 years, years, he lost his position as a lobbyist for a labor organization because they asked for his resignation because he was perceived to have been intervening in this dispute on behalf of Pam Yocum. The last time Democrats had the majority in the Iowa Senate, Mike Gronstahl held the top position, which is called the Senate Majority Leader, and Pam Yocum held the number two position, which was the Senate President.
So this is not a good look for Democrats. They're a minority anyway, a serious minority. And here they oust their leader in an off-legislative time here. Is the Democratic Party in chaos right now?
Well, I really don't know. I mean, there's a lot that's not clear about this change. As we discussed last week, it partly was certainly related to Zach Walls replacing these two longtime staffers who, by the way, Pam Yocum rehired. So they are back working for the Senate Democrats now. But I think that there were more things bubbling below the surface. And when there's a change like this in the middle, that's not right after an election, it's never a good look. This did happen a few years ago when Rob Hogue was the Senate Minority Leader. He was replaced by Janet Peterson. I think the perception was that maybe they thought that Rob Hogue wasn't a strong fundraiser. It was never really clear exactly what was going on. But I mean, the trajectory, it's just difficult. This is a difficult political map for Iowa Democrats. They don't even hold enough seats right now to block confirmation of any of the governor's appointees. And it is clearly, it's a difficult time for the party.
Let's talk about Governor Reynolds. She made news last week, but only with you. She bypassed a qualified judicial candidate to appoint another qualified candidate. However, there's a story behind that story, and you broke it.
So I don't report on every district court judge appointment of the governor. There are quite a few of those, but I had been keeping my eye out for this one, and it was announced. It was a classic, what we call a Friday news dump. News came late in the afternoon last Friday, and of course, the story that was dominating the headlines was the Iowa Supreme Court's non-action, which kept abortion legal. But I've been watching this because the former Iowa House Republican Dustin Height, who was one of the incumbents who had opposed the governor's school voucher plan. He was the chair of the House Education Committee. He didn't bring the plan up in his committee. And somebody who went last year when the governor was endorsing opponents to several of the incumbents in the Iowa House, this was one of those districts that the governor appointed Helena Hayes, and she did defeat Dustin Height in the primary. But he's an attorney, a longtime attorney practicing in Oskaloosa. And so when I heard that he was a finalist for this judgeship, I thought, well, that's really interesting. And then I heard the other finalist for the judgeship was a Democratic trial lawyer who's very involved with the Trial Lawyers Association. He's a longtime practicing attorney from Ottumwa. And again, as you said, they are both very qualified candidates. But normally, a Republican governor would not pass up a highly qualified Republican candidate, especially since Governor Reynolds really has appointed quite a few former Republican legislators to quite a few offices. And so when I saw the news that she had instead appointed the Democratic trial attorney, Michael Carpenter, to this position, I wrote about it. And I can guarantee you that a lot of people within the legislature, they noticed this appointment and they were talking about it last Friday.
So this was political payback.
Well, it certainly appears that way. And I have filed a records request, so we'll see what I come up with. It's hard to know. I mean, the governor's office, the press release that announced three different judicial appointments, I mean, it was just very brief. It didn't give any reason. But that is certainly the perception. And Dustin Height, I mean, he really supported the governor on a lot of things. He ran the bill. He floor managed the bill that banned schools and local governments from having mask mandates in 2021. We talked about that. He also helped fast-track the bill through his committee that required school districts to offer 100% in-person instruction. That was in January of 2021. So it's not that he was somebody who was frequently sparring with the governor or opposing the governor, but it certainly, this is how the appointment was perceived, as the governor sending a strong message to Republican legislators, and that she still seems to be upset, even though she did get a much expanded version of her school voucher plan passed into law this year.
From political payback to pigs, Governor Reynolds urged Congress to overturn California's animal welfare law last week, signed a letter urging Congress to overturn the law which dictates the conditions of livestock that produce meat sold in California.
Yes, and this is a case where the governor had joined. There was a multi-state action to try to challenge this California law. It failed in the U.S. Supreme Court. Basically, the majority opinion rejected the lawsuit, and so they're going to Congress. And the Republican members of Congress, are both in the U.S. House and Senate, are very much on board with passing some kind of federal law that would outlaw state actions like what we've seen in California. But basically, I mean, if that gets through the U.S. House, it's certainly not going anywhere in the Democratic-controlled U.S. Senate, not right now.
Another story. State Board of Regents last week voted to hike tuition by 3.5% at Iowa State, University of Iowa, and the University of Northern Iowa. Not a surprise. They were always going to do this. But the reasons they gave.
Yes. Well, the legislature approved basically a status quo budget for the three state universities this year, even though we are in an inflationary time. I mean, costs go up every year regardless, even when inflation is low, and costs have been rising more quickly. And the Republican legislature just didn't want – there were a handful of programs that received targeted funding, like a new fellowship for OBGYNs at the University of Iowa. But basically, they got a status quo budget. And so it's hard to see how they could make their finances work without some kind of tuition increase. And in fact, when the Iowa House and Senate were debating this appropriations bill, this exact outcome was predicted by several of the Democrats who spoke against the budget bill.
And that tuition hike came on the same day the Regents approved salary hikes for the University of Iowa president and the University of Northern Iowa president, but not an increase for Iowa State President Wendy Winterstein.
Yes, and you know, I don't know all of the reasoning behind that. I do know that it is typical that for the Board of Regents to give those university presidents raises, so I'm not sure exactly what their thought process was on Wendy Winterstein, but it is normal. I didn't think that the raises were out of line from what we've seen in the past from the Regents, but of course, it's not a great look, especially when they're raising tuition.
Also last week, more word that more applicants for state money to pay for private schools have come in than anticipated. The number keeps rising. This is quite interesting.
Yes. Well, when the education savings accounts bill or the school voucher plan, whatever you want to call it, I think the governor calls it the students first bill. When that was signed in January, many people warned that this is an unlimited appropriation. It wasn't capped at a certain dollar amount a year. This was certain people will qualify, and if you qualify for it, you're eligible for the money. And the Legislative Services Agency, which is a nonpartisan professional group of analysts, they do really great work. But when they put a fiscal note on a bill like this, it's just their best guess. And their best guess was that the first year of this program would cost the state about $107 million. And that is what the legislature appropriated just before adjourning in May. And now we see that the number of applications for these scholarships is much more than was anticipated, and it's possible that this program could cost $133 million and not $107 million. And so I think that when the legislature comes back in January, they're going to need to approve some kind of special supplemental appropriations bill just to make sure they keep this thing funded.
And the estimate was that after 3 years, it would cost about $345 million a year. That may have to go way up.
Oh, I think so. And I mean, people were talking even during the legislative debates, this could easily end up costing $400 million a year or more. And we also don't know whether new private schools are going to be created, either brick and mortar schools or online schools that may be accredited by the Department of Education. And so absolutely, especially after year two and in the third year and beyond, there's going to be no income limit. And so I think that we may well find out that this Legislative Services Agency estimate of $345 million a year, that's probably going to look like a lowball.
Now let's go to Warren County. Ah, yes, Democrats there won a special election after an election denier, yes, an election denier, was named county auditor.
So Warren County, this is immediately south of Polk County. This is where the largest city is Indianola. Norwalk and Carlisle are also part of Warren County. And this is one of these classic, mid-sized counties, or some people call them micropolitan counties. They're counties with medium-sized cities of populations of between 10,000 and 30,000. And many of these counties, like Warren County, used to be fairly strong Democratic voting counties and have shifted to be very Republican. And so the Democratic county auditor was the last Democrat to be elected to a countywide office. She was a long-serving incumbent, very well-liked. But when she stepped down in the middle of her term, the three county supervisors right now are all Republicans. And so there were two applicants. There was the current deputy county auditor who's worked in the office for a number of years. And then there was a Republican who really hasn't worked in election administration. So the supervisors unanimously agreed to appoint him. And it caused a local uproar because people going through his Facebook posts had seen that in late 2020 and early 2021, he was posting QAnon conspiracy video. He posted about how Donald Trump that the election was stolen from Donald Trump. He seemed to post something very fairly favorable to January 6th. And so that led citizens in Warren County to try to use the state process that's allowed under state law to petition for a special election. And I have learned this afternoon that they did submit another enough signatures. It hasn't been certified by the county yet, but they submitted more than enough certain signatures. They needed about 2,400. They submitted close to 3,500 signatures demanding a special election. So it's very likely that later this summer, Warren County voters are going to elect the new local election administrator.
And we will be following that. One more note before we get on to another topic. A black newspaper. Iowa has a long history of black journalism, but it's been without a print newspaper produced by and for black Iowans for a long time until last week.
Yes, Dana James, and by the way, happy Juneteenth today. Dana James created the Black Iowa News website and newsletter about 3 years ago, and she decided last year that it was time to try to revive a print newspaper. That it's, although Black Iowa News reaches thousands of people every week, there are still a lot of people who don't regularly use the internet. And a newspaper, I mean, it's important people pass a newspaper around. There is evidence that there she printed out a black voter guide for before last year's midterm election, and it was very well received within the black community. And so she's been working on this project for about the last 6 months, and I picked up a copy of the newspaper last week. It's a very interesting, the goal, Dana James' goal is centering black voices, elevating black perspectives. She plans to publish it quarterly this year. She's hoping it's going to come out monthly in 2024, and it's being distributed for free. The business model is she's running ads in the paper, but it's going to be distributed for free at many different community locations, and the blackiowanews.com website, you can see places where you can pick up copies of the newspaper.
And the best of luck to her from both Laura and myself. It's about 15 minutes to the top of the hour. This is indeed Capital Week on KHOI, your best seat in the House when it comes to Iowa politics. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bell, and yes, we're going a full hour tonight to celebrate the fact that we are actually in studio together for the first time, believe it or not, though we have done this broadcast for 124 weeks now. Laura, it doesn't seem possible.
It really is amazing, but it's been a lot of fun. It feels like it's gone quickly.
We have done this through thick and thin. You have had a broken ankle. You've broadcast from the hospital. When you broke your ankle walking Sammy the dog, you have had the coronavirus and done this broadcast. You have been a trooper.
Yes, the show from the hospital, that was quite the thing. My surgeon was surprised that we were doing that, but fortunately they had a good Wi-Fi connection.
And you're recovered now. We should say you're recovered from all of this.
Yes, yes.
All right. People have asked me this. They've asked you this. We're going to spend the last few minutes of this broadcast at the top of the hour trying to answer this question. What has happened to Iowa politics in the last few years? We used to be a purple state that elected Democrats and Republicans to the governor's office, to the U.S. Senate, to the congressional offices. All right, Laura, let's kick this off. We're now a deep red state. What has happened to Iowa?
This is probably the most common question I get asked when I speak to groups around the state. And because actually, for most of Iowa history, we were a red state, really, for the first 100 years or more, a pretty solidly red state with very rare occasions of Democrats getting elected to statewide office. But beginning around the 1970s, we were much more of a swing state. For decades, we elected Tom Harkin, the liberal Democrat, and, of course, Chuck Grassley, who is still representing Iowa in the U.S. Senate. We elected members of both parties to the U.S. House, and we had for 12 years Democratic governors. And what has gone on? Our presidential vote used to be very closely following the national popular vote, and that started diverging in 2016. And now Iowa as a whole votes about 6 points more Republican than the country as a whole. At least that's in the last two presidential elections. And what is going on? And I guess the biggest thing I think is it's a demographic question. So the changes in Iowa, it's a function of the fact that the Iowa electorate is predominantly white voters without a college degree. And if you look at white voters without a college degree, really across the country, everywhere, but especially in the upper Midwest, you find many, many areas that used to be strongly Democratic for decades and are now voting Republican. And the thing is, it doesn't make as much of a difference in a state like Minnesota, where the Twin Cities are more than 60% of the state's population, or in Michigan, where the Detroit metro area is more than a third of the state's population. In Iowa, the Des Moines metro area is at most 1/6 of the population, and that includes the suburbs, which are not particularly Democratic leaning. So Iowa does not have an urban core. Iowa has a lot of communities where the predominant voters are white people without a college degree. And so I think that that has caused the biggest shift, and that's why you see many towns that were Democratic, elected Democrats to the legislature for decades before I was even born. Places like Fort Dodge and Ottumwa and Newton and Clinton and Burlington that are now electing Republicans. It's something that, honestly, the previous generations would have found hard to believe.
We have seen that erosion, particularly, as you say, in the eastern counties. Used to be heavily Democratic, Catholic, and Union, and both of those have eroded for the Democrats.
Yes, and again, white Catholics, this is a national trend that people have written about, that white Catholic voters, I mean, the Kennedy Democrats, increasingly every year more of them pass away, and white Catholics as a group have begun voting more and more Republican, and there are many counties in Iowa that are fairly heavily Catholic. When Donald Trump carried Dubuque County in the 2016 election, it was the first time a Republican presidential candidate had carried that county since 1956. That is how solidly Republican Dubuque was, but Donald Trump carried it again in 2020. Ashley Hinson, the Republican member of Congress from Northeast Iowa, carried it in her reelection bid last year. And so we see this is a trend that is happening in a lot of places. It just seems to be more pronounced in Iowa because of the way our electorate is structured.
What did Trump tap into those Democratic strongholds? What emotions did he tap into to be able to turn that away from Democrats?
Well, I think it started certainly during Barack Obama's presidency, and the 2010 red wave was really part of that, and the 2014 wave also. I mean, that was those were elections when a lot of previously Democratic counties started voting Republican more and more. So I do think that Donald Trump had an effective message. I think that there are other things going on as well. I think conservative talk radio is very dominant in small town Iowa. There really is no liberal talk radio at all. And many people are listening to radio for hours a day. And so I think that that has hurt. That's something that Republican candidates don't even really have to pay for. It's just something, it's publicity that they get 365 days a year. And that helps them. I mean, Donald Trump is clearly an effective communicator for a certain part of the electorate. And that's why we see him. I mean, this, as we talked about last week, this is truly unprecedented to have someone under criminal indictment who's not only is he not resigning from the campaign, but his campaign doesn't seem to be affected by it.
I've also heard it said that the demise of the Des Moines Register as a statewide newspaper, a moderating influence, which made Iowa different back then compared to Nebraska, let's say, that's had a big role because the Register is now shrunken, barely alive in Des Moines. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's an interesting idea. I definitely think that the media environment plays a role. I had Macklin Sheldrup, who was the data director for the Iowa Democratic Party last year. He wrote a couple of pieces for my website about doing a deep dive on ticket splitting. And one thing he found that was very interesting was that in the counties that are part of the Des Moines media market, I'm talking about television markets now, the Des Moines and the Cedar Rapids media markets, that's dozens of counties, that there is substantially more ticket splitting. And one possible explanation for that is that people are watching stations and they're getting predominantly their Iowa news on TV, whereas people living in other media markets where candidates aren't spending as much money on advertising, or let's say the Omaha market, where a lot of the news coverage might be about what's happening in Nebraska, or the Quad Cities market, where a lot of the coverage is about what's happening in Illinois, we see a lot more straight ticket voting. And that has been to the detriment of Democrats in recent elections.
All right. We have about 3 minutes left to fix this for Democrats. What do Democrats have to do to overcome talk radio, which is largely conservative, the demise of the Register? What do Democrats have to do?
I think it's a really difficult question. I don't have the answer. I mean, one thing I will say, and this is something I hear a lot from people, that Democrats stop talking to voters. And I want to tell you that that's just not true. I mean, I have talked to many state legislative candidates, candidates for county offices. They knock thousands of doors. They go to every spaghetti supper and pancake breakfast. They make thousands of direct voter contacts. And sometimes these were long-serving incumbents who served in the legislature senator for multiple terms and perhaps before that had a role like mayor or county supervisor, and they're still losing their reelection bids. And it's not because they stopped talking to people. So I'm not sure. I mean, I think something needs to change more broadly, not just in Iowa, but more broadly to bring back some of these disaffected voters. And we do periodically see these political realignments that happened in the 1980s with what at that time they called the Reagan Democrats. And I think something like that would need to occur really on almost a national scale.
We've talked about the pendulum in the past swinging, and right now it's to the right in Iowa with statewide office holders. It takes a while for the pendulum to swing back in Kansas. It took a while. They went quite conservative and cut taxes and all of this, and now they're swinging back. Do you see that happening here in Iowa down the road, down a long road?
Well, I mean, I think that's the goal in Kansas. They elected a Democratic governor in 2018. Things went really south with the state budget, and they just reelected the Democratic governor, even though it is still a Republican-controlled legislature. And I think that that's the optimistic scenario for Iowa Democrats as they talk about if things get bad with the state budget and the school, the voucher program turns out to be very expensive and adversely affects public schools, electing a Democratic governor in 2026 or 2030 seems very possible. I mean, winning back state legislative majorities, it seems like that could take quite a long time. And I was going back through Iowa history again. As I mentioned, Iowa was really a solid Republican state for a very long time. We had a brief period of Democratic legislative majorities when FDR came in 1932. We then had, after the 1964 LBJ landslide, that brought in a Democratic trifecta that only lasted for 2 years. And then the Democrats didn't have another trifecta until 2007. So it really could be a process that takes decades.
And briefly, how do the Democrats attract candidates who can actually attract voters?
Well, and candidate recruitment is always really difficult, especially for a seat that seems to be an uphill battle. I think that what's going on with abortion rights, I think that's something that's going to inspire a lot of candidates. I think that the school, that educators are a strong part of the Democratic Party base. I think that what's happening with the public schools is going to bring in more candidates as well. But the problem is how do you overcome, I mean, how do you make enough direct voter contacts to overcome the messages people are hearing from the electronic media? And that's just a difficult nut to crack.
Laura, we have about 30 seconds left before we have to start signing off. It has been a true pleasure being with you in studio at KHOI on Douglas Avenue here in Des Moines, Ames. On this Monday night, we're going to be rebroadcasting this on Tuesday and Wednesday. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Absolutely. It's really nice to drive up to Ames. I've never been in the studio before, and honestly, I haven't broadcast very often from a radio studio. I mean, I just don't. My background is in print online journalism and not in broadcast journalism, so this has been really fun for me as well, Dennis.
We are going to continue doing this broadcast from our respective locations, and I look forward to it. But for this Monday night, thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
All right. We are out of time for this special edition of Capital Week. And as I indicated to Laura, it has been a pleasure to share this studio with her for the first time. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Now, Laura and I are going to be back next week in this same time slot, whatever time slot you're listening to us, with our regular edition of Capital Week. And no matter where you are then, and no matter where we are then, we're going to talk about everything interesting, important, or entertaining about politics, Iowa style, because that's who we are, and that's what we like doing. So as always, we hope you can join us. Please do, wherever you are. Thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We always appreciate it. We always value it. So between now and next time, and Laura, let's both say this, we hope you have a safe, healthy,
and happy week.
Bye-bye.
Support your local radio station. Visit khoifm.org/membership.